1 Samuel chapter 11. Now Hoash, the Ammonites, came up and besieged Yabesh Gilead, and all the men of Yabesh came to Nahash. Make a covenant with us, and we will serve you. But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, I will make it with you on this condition, that I will gouge out the right eye of every one of you. Thus I will make it a reproach on all Israel. The elders of Yabesh said to him, Let us alone for 7 days, that we may send messengers throughout the territory of Israel. Then, if there is no one to deliver us, we will come out to you. Then the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and spoke these words in the hearing of the people. And all the people lifted up their voices and wept. Now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen, and he said, What is the matter with the people that they weep? So they related to him the words of the men of Yabesh. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry. He took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of the messenger, saying, Whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen. Then the dread of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out as one man. He numbered them in Bezek, and the sons of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. They said to the messengers who had come, Thus you shall say to the men of Yabesh Gilead, Tomorrow, by the time the sun is hot, you will have deliverance. So the messengers went out and told the men of Yabesh, and they were glad. Then the men of Yabesh said, Tomorrow we will come out to you, and you may do to us whatever seems good to you. The next morning, Saul put the people in three companies. They came into the midst of the camp at morning watch and struck down the Ammonites until the heat of the day. Those who survived were scattered, so that no two of them were left together. Then the people said to Samuel, Who is he that said, Shall Saul reign over us? Bring them in, that we may put them to death. But Saul said, Not a man shall be put to death on this day, for today the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel. Then Samuel said to the people, Come and let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they also offered sacrifices and made peace offerings before the Lord. And there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly.
Any questions or comments regarding 1 Samuel chapter 11? Now, I know we discussed chapter 10. And of course, chapter 11 is a continuation of 9 and 10, which we have met Saul in chapter 9. And then, of course, he gets crowned king in chapter 10, anointed ruler in chapter 10. And now, this is his first opportunity to prove himself as a leader. Are there any comments or questions regarding what you've read, or what you heard, read today, before I go to my commentary? Nothing catch your attention at all? Yes, hey.
Well, like you said, not as much a king, more a, a judge. What was Gilead? A judge. Just at like Samson, how the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. Mm-hmm. You know.
Same principle.
Yeah.
Yep. And it, Hank, of course, for those who aren't familiar with, God never called Saul king. God never anointed him as king. Samuel never anointed Saul as king. The word used was someone who will rule, reign, or guide. God uses king when he talks about anointing David, not Saul. Saul's not the king that God chose. Saul is the ruler that God chose, which is very similar to what the judges would do. Judges, of course, had two tasks, spiritual elevation and physical war. Two things they did. Saul was really good at the physical war. Samuel, however, was still their spiritual guide to the people. That never changed. Never changed hands. Kingship, Though, yes, you don't have to have a spiritual guide to be a king either. Kingship was given to David and David's line only, not to Saul. Rulership was given to Saul. It was only given to him for 2 years. Only 2 years before David gets anointed king. Very brief period of time for him. He drops the ball rather quickly. So, if there are no comments or questions, there's a couple of things I actually want to mention regarding last week's... Oh, yes.
Okay, I did have a question.
Go ahead.
What is the difference between the ruler and king?
King is perpetual, generation to generation to generation.
Okay.
Ruler is your rule until you don't rule anymore.
Okay.
Judges were rulers. Their children did not rule after them. They died and somebody else would come up. God would raise, you know, the next person up or the person after that. New generation, new family line, unrelated to the previous one. The only ones that came from one generation to the next failed miserably, and they were for very short periods of time.
Okay.
A year, a few months before the next generation was, where God said, I don't think so. Unless you're somebody who's better than your descendant was.
So would it be right to say that a ruler just had a defined time to rule?
A finite, yes. Yeah, a fine limit. Whatever that limit is, it varies. Some to generations, some for months, some for years. It just dictated.
So are the priests the only ones? Priests and kings are the only ones that come from the same line?
Correct.
When we looked at this last time, we discussed the fact that the first time Messiah came, he didn't come as a king, and the second time he came as a king, as a prophetic overlord.
Correct.
It is traditionally, through the church from forever, that the Messiah's ministry was 3.5 years. But that has come into challenge.
As far as exactly,
maybe
right.
It was 1.5 high day cycles, which would make it about 2 years.
Possibly. Possibly. That's a whole other theological argument. whether or not Messiah... By the way, again, for those of you who were not here, back when we first met Saul in chapter 9, and of course, continued chapter 10, we noted there were a lot of parallels between what was going on in Saul's life and what was happening to him that also paralleled what happened to Messiah while he was flesh and blood on earth. To contrast that, a lot of parallels in David's selection process that happens to Messiah in our future. Not Messiah's future, but in our future, for his second coming. There was a lot of parallel between the two of them, a lot of consistencies, interesting tidbits of information that God didn't just happenstance, just throw things on there because he felt like it. There were details there, things to catch your attention and watch for. So it's one can easily argue that the first king Saul, or reign of Saul, was very similar to the first reign of the Messiah when he first came here of flesh and blood. A lot of similar characteristics and events happened. So that's what she was referring to. Any other comments? I'm going to go into my little spiel. So what I left out last time, chapter 10, I ran out of time. I know we're like 15 minutes over, which is not uncommon. Why was Saul the luggage? I know we didn't read this time. There was a question brought up is that when they were going through and they were looking for Saul, when Samuel had narrowed down from this group to that group to generation to generation all the way down, and Saul was the last person selected, where is he? Well, he wasn't amongst the leaders who were there. And who were the leaders? The heads of the households. Who was Saul's leader? His father, Kish. His father, Kish, was the dominant warrior, not Saul. Saul was in his 40s, give or take. Could be 50s, it's debatable, but most likely in his 40s. Kish would have been older, but Kish was the head of the household. Saul wasn't. So what was Saul doing? What the first son is supposed to do. Work. Take care of my stuff. Pretty simple. Saul is a humble person. Was, I should say. A humble person. That was a great, perfect characteristic of the first ruler. To be humble. That's key. Because that's the kind of person that you want as the very first king. The one that people, well, do I have to obey this guy? Do I like this guy? I don't know yet. I don't have to care. I don't like him. Get rid of him. Or yes, I will follow him. He didn't let it go to his head initially. He does that eventually. Nobody's perfect. And unfortunately, he wasn't either. But initially, he stayed humble. And of course, this chapter continues on his humbleness. What was he doing when the messengers come?
Plowing.
Yeah, he's plowing the field with his oxen. Can you imagine Barack Obama plowing a field with his oxen? No. Or the Queen of England?
Yeah.
Not likely. I wouldn't imagine them doing that. They'd hire somebody else to do it. But no, he's still a very humble person. He maintained that humility early on, which is a good key, a very important factor. Not quite the same as what David did, but very similar in the nature as far as the lowly status that they understood and were acceptable and comfortable with. They maintained that. So, I want to put out, that's why he was still with the luggage. First son, yes, Kish was a small family line. Saul was his only son. We don't know if he had any other kids or not, for sure, but we know he was his only son. And Saul was just taking care of the stuff. Maintained his humbleness, which is good. This shows up again here. Okay, so that's what I meant to comment about last time, but I ran out of time. Okay. Verse 1 of chapter 11. Right here. Nahash, the Ammonite. Not that this is terribly important, but what does his name mean?
Sayers.
What was that?
Sayers.
Sort of. Yes, he's right. It means sayers, but a particular type of sayer.
Is that right?
No. We've run across a person with a similar type of name, but it's one who has a slippery tongue. The actual word itself in Hebrew means snake. Oh. That's what his name. The snake. The snake of Ammon is his name. Is that the name his father and mother gave him? No. Probably not. Most likely he probably took it on as he got older. And maybe. Some speaking pirate name, yes. Most likely it was either given to him or he took it as he got older and became a ruthless individual. So King Ammon. What was that?
Proud of it.
And probably was very proud of it. Note his tactic of war is indicative of someone who was quite disgusting and rotten. So, Naish, the snake of Ammon, went up to besiege Jabesh-Gilead. And all people just said, please, Selah, come with us, and we will serve you. We'll stop there for a minute. We've met the people of Jabesh-Gilead before. This is the fundamental point of where God establishes Saul is in this one event. And it's so important that God chose this particular town for Saul because of who Saul is and where his descendants came from. What tribe is Saul from?
Benjamin.
What do we know about the tribe of Benjamin? Big event that happened in their tribe's history.
They almost got wiped out.
Who almost wiped them out?
Everybody else.
There was a civil war. Yeah. If you recall, this is the book of Judges. I believe it is chapter 21. You don't have to go there. We've already read the book of Judges. We're going forward, not back. But we just refer to things. Judges 21, verses 8 and through 9 or 10. It discusses, of course, the people of Gibeah, I believe it was. Had taken some inappropriate action toward a concubine of Levite. She died as a result. They intended to rape him, but he gave him her so that they would live through the night, and of course she's dead by morning. He, the Levite, cuts her up into parts and distributes her body throughout all of Israel to get the people rallied up and say, this is evil, we need to purge this evil from us. So all the armies of Israel travel to, I forgot the name of the town, but it's a few miles, or actually probably less than a couple miles, north of Gibeah, northwest, I believe, northeast of Gibeah. They all get together, they say, what is this, what happened? Of course, Levite explains what had happened to the Gibeah, by the way, is a major metropolis city, which we call as a small rinky-dink town but nowadays, but then it was really big inside the heart of Benjamin's territory. It's a Benjamite town. They all get together. They say, okay, we'll go to war. They go to war. Of course, the people of Israel, not Benjamin, the people of Israel get heavily hurt in this war. They lose large numbers of their soldiers. They do it again. Again, large numbers of their soldiers are slaughtered. Benjamin is a very talented warrior. Their people were very good at, skilled at what they did. And in a few weeks from now, I'll be able to explain to you why they were so skilled, because they had a unique tool that is common to Israel's society, but not their native people around them. It's the style of slings they used. It's very fascinating on what they used and how they were shaped and why they used them. But beyond that, Benjamin had many left-handed slingers. As opposed to right-handed slingers. You're right-handed, you sling. Well, if I'm a recipient and I'm right-handed, okay, my shield's up. But if you're a left-handed slinger, guess where the ball's, where the rock is coming from? Your right side, where there's the opponent, where there's no shield.
I would have made out good there. I'm left-handed.
You probably would have made out well. So they're actually very skilled at killing. Now, of course, we know eventually the third battle shows up and Israel eventually wins after God, after they go to God and say, all right, please help us. Should we just quit? And God says, no, go ahead and take care of them. You've been punished enough for the other crimes, which we won't discuss today. They wipe out all of Benjamin. I believe there were 200 men left. Men, women, children, everybody else dead. All males, only males left. What happens when there are only males left of a population?
It
dies rather quickly. I mean, males can't reproduce, in case you're unaware of that.
We are now.
Well, okay, let's not go there. Miracles of science, yeah. So males couldn't reproduce. So what do the people of Israel do? Well, oh no, we've slaughtered all of Benjamin, rightfully so, because of the corrupt and evilness that they were doing and perpetrating and condoning, but now we're going to wipe out one of our own tribes. So what did they do? Well, they went and they found, you know, anybody who had a spare daughter, whatever, okay, give them to Benjamin. But it wasn't enough. So then what idea did they come up with? Yes, Susan.
And they were dancing in the vineyard at the grape harvest.
Exactly.
They stole the women.
They stole the women. Them. Now, which women did they steal? I'll give you a hint. Yabesh Gilead's women. They looked amongst themselves and said, all right, Israel, all the extra warriors, not the ones of Benjamin, who didn't come to our battle? The men of Yabesh Gilead didn't come to their battle. So they said, all right, let's go to Yabesh Gilead, slaughter everybody that they can find, take their women who are virgins, and give them to Benjamin. That was their intention. Now, of course, Benjamin instead just kidnapped them. So the same difference. The point is, the people of Yabesh Gilead, women, were given to Benjamin, Saul's ancestors. God does things in full circle, in case you're not aware of that. He repeats himself to get the point across. So, Saul was saved by the people of Yabesh Gilead. Now, the people of Yabesh Gilead are saved by Saul. Seems kind of interesting. Okay. Unique little debate. Okay, whatever. God doesn't do whatever. There's a reason why God chose this as an event, which we'll get into as we get to this chapter. He didn't arbitrarily choose just some town. Curiosity. No, it's more than a curiosity. This is actually a key factor in Saul's life. Yeah, what happens to him. Okay, so the snake goes of Ammon, says, okay, we'll, you know, come take you out. The people of Yabesh Gilead said, please, please, no, give us 7 days. Why do you think the king of Ammon would say, okay, 7 days? Yes, Tammy.
I have an interesting theory on this. When you read earlier, when they were basically said, we'll do whatever you want, we'll serve you, blah, 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 and he says, okay, I'll put out your eyes, blah, 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 and whatever. And then they said, oh, give us 7 days. I think Mr. Nahash or whatever wanted a fight. The reason he was wanting to, he was threatening to humiliate them like that is because he wanted them, you know, he figured, well, if they're cowardly enough to let me do that, then I want everybody to know how cowardly they are. He wanted a fight.
He was picking a fight.
He was picking a fight.
You're absolutely right. She's right.
He was out blood.
Right. Now, did he care who he fought? Well, actually, he did care. He didn't want to fight the people of Yabesh Gilead. That's a small town as far as he's concerned. And his army, he could have wiped them out in a few minutes. Well, probably a few hours. They didn't have any bullets, but a few hours before he could take the town out. He would give them 7 days, and they actually told him why. So we can find somebody to come fight you. He said, okay. What? You're going
to
hold off attacking a town so the town can muster somebody else to come bite you.
He wanted some glory and some blood in his sword.
Exactly. The guy, he There's a reason he's called a snake. He was after the humiliation of all of Israel, not just some people in one town. That's just what started it. His goal was to humiliate and shame the entire countryside, because two things could have happened. One, the whole countryside come and fight him, and hopefully, of course, his might, he wins. Thus, he humiliates Israel. The other is if nobody comes. He gets to humiliate this town and rub it in Israel's face. You are so cowardly. I gave you a week, and you couldn't save. You wouldn't even come face me. That's dominance. That's a power play. The king of Ammon is a snake, yeah, but that's... he's doing his job. He wanted to... we all discuss current political people, but... he wanted to humiliate them, to shame them. That's his motive for waiting the 7 days. Because, honestly, modern-day military, I highly doubt you get a general say, okay, and wait. We don't do that anymore. We don't, after our personal glory, we attack and move on. That's the technique, as opposed to this to wait and see and wait till somebody shows up to fight you. So it's a little bit, little different. So, of course, Jabesh Gilead sends messengers out. We already read that. Go, they finally make it their way to Saul's town, which is Gibeah of Saul, or it's just his home little town. It's outside of the actual major city of Gibeah. Or Gibeah, sorry. Pronounce that correctly. Two different towns. Gibeah. He's a farmer. He's farming. He's probably out in the field. The messengers come. They came to him because he's king. You have to go notify the king, whose job it is to go fight your battles. Now, we learned at the end of chapter 10, the army of Israel followed Saul once they knew what okay, he's king, we will follow him. So they're with him, not physically living there, but they're at his call when he needs to. Right, the town's too small to store that many people. But they can be called up by him whenever he needs. So he had the army's ability, he had the army's leader following. They would obey what he asked for. So the messengers come from Gilead. They probably went other places as well. Don't get me wrong. Let's say they didn't. But they would go to Saul and say, hey, we have this problem. Saul was out farming. They didn't find him. What did they do? They told the whole town. Until Saul came back. So what's going on? Oh, well, there you are. This is what happened. So Saul cuts up his oxen, or two oxen. It doesn't say necessarily his, but I think they're probably his. Why? Well, as we had remembered, the story of Jabesh Gilead, which Saul knew quite well, what did the Levite do? Cut up his concubine, who had died during the process of the mass gang rape thing, whatever happened. And distributed throughout the whole countryside. He is using the same symbolisms to go through it again, to inspire the country to go to battle. He didn't use a person. He used an ox, which is still an important thing to use. It's still a valuable animal. Scattered it amongst the countryside, it invokes the same memories. I mean, not that you personally were alive back then, and none of the people here were alive back when the concubine was sliced up, but they still know what happened. There's a point why it's recorded in your Bible. It's not just arbitrary. It's recorded because it occurred, and everybody remembers that it occurred. So when Saul sends out this ox, it goes, of course, all the countryside, all the way up to Naphtali and Asher, and of course, we go down to Simeon. I don't know if we'd make it to Dan, because they were doing other stuff that time, but which we'll discuss this in another moment. But everybody else would have gotten it. Maybe Dan. I don't know for sure. But they would have gotten the message. They got everything. They all come together at Bezek, which is written up here. Now, so Saul sends the message out, and they buy a little map. Up to Bezek. I don't know if it's quite that wavy. It doesn't really matter. It's a mountainous terrain. It probably did a little wave there. So go to Bezek. 300,000 of Israel, actually 300 clans, technically what the word phrase is, and 30 clans of Judah. Anybody else catch that? Yeah. I'm sure you probably did. You guys are pretty smart people. Yeah. So it says, let's see where else, what verse it was. Eight, thank you. So 300 clans of Israel plus 30 clans of Judah. Why is Judah counted separately? Aren't they part of Israel? Nope. They sort of are. This is not the only time that Judah gets counted separate from all the other tribes which are grouped together.
Back.
It happened back then. It's going to happen again from here earlier. And if what Saul sees is about a year from now, he does it again. Judah gets counted independent of all of Israel. This is before the tribes haven't broken up yet. They're not two countries yet. They're still one. Why is Judah counted independent? Any ideas? Oh, come on, there's some idea somewhere. Why do you think Judah would be independent of all the other tribes? Two reasons. Since there aren't anybody who's willing to guess. Number one reason, Genesis 41, verse 8 through 10. 49, I'm sorry. Genesis 49, verses 8 through 10. And I left my Bible at my desk. That was unwise of me. So what happened in Genesis 49? Anybody recall? Well, let's go there and take a look.
Jacob is giving his final
prophecy. Yes, he's giving, exactly. He's blessing his sons. All 12 plus, you know, I know Jacob, or Joseph gets split into two. We're not going to read the entire chapter of Genesis 49. It takes too long. But note how many times we come back to this chapter so far. Well, I don't remember. There's probably quite a few. Well, we've come back to it quite a number of times. Because the blessings that Jacob give in this one chapter get fulfilled to each of those sons differently, in different ways, different times. But there's a reason why they're called prophets. This is a prophecy. Thus, it will be fulfilled. That's the whole point of a prophecy. If it doesn't feel fulfilled, it's not a prophecy anymore, is it? So, Genesis 49. Judah, this is verse 8. You are he whom your brothers shall praise. Your hands shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down. He lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who shall rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. Until Shiloh comes, or the one to whom it belongs, comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the people. Binding his donkey to the vine, his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine, and his clothes shall be blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. What does that mean? Well, there's a lot of things that it means. We're not discussing everything of the prophecy, we're discussing just a few aspects of it. In particular, what does it say about Judah and his brothers?
His brothers will bow down to him.
Exactly. They will consider him more important than themselves. That's key. What else does it say regarding Judah and his throne?
The scepter will never depart from him.
Right. And the one never between his legs. I mean, his descendants will always continue on. But that hasn't happened yet, is it?
Establishing laws.
Establishing laws. But that hasn't happened to Judah yet. Isn't Benjamin the rulership? Saul's from Benjamin, not Judah. That the prophecy didn't occur? Well, not yet. It didn't occur. It occurs with David, but it will occur, but not quite yet. Because we, of course, have to go through Saul's story, because you have to get Saul before you can get a David. You have to do a contrast between the two of them. Judah is counted separately because why? It's more important than the rest of the brothers. What was that? Say it again. I think I heard you. It's part of the line?
Lion.
Oh, lion.
No, the line.
The line. Oh, going down. It's part of David's line. That's true. Part of David's line. It is the strength of Israel. Today in Israel, modern day Israel, who is the primary... Oops, turn it off again. Be careful there. Who are the primary occupants other than Muslims and Palestinians? We're not going to discuss that group. But regarding the lions of Israel, or of Jacob, who currently lives there?
Jews.
Judah lives there. They're still around. What about Issachar? Does he live there?
No.
No, not at all. Zebulun? Oh, bummer. I guess he didn't make it. Asher? Dan? Simeon? Maybe. Probably not. Bits and parts. A few smatterings of Levi's hanging around too, but they didn't get a territory, so they don't count. Benjamin? Some pieces, bits and parts. The vast majority of those brothers are gone.
Disappeared, in a sense.
Reuben's gone, Gad's gone, Manasseh's gone. They're all gone. Who ended up being the dominant of Israel?
Judah.
Why do you think they're counted separately? Because they knew they were still dominant. Judah, by the way, at this point in history, is the largest tribe of all the tribes. They outnumber all but, I think, if you could almost add the rest of the tribes together, and Judah's about three quarters of it as far as their size at this point in history. They're a very big tribe, and they stay large. They're counted separately because they are separate. God separated them, and their father separated them.
Isn't it because what I meant by line is that it was the line of Jesus, too?
That's, yes. That's regarding David's line, yes, because that travels through. It's required. It's required to do that. And that's the other part of the prophecy, which we didn't talk about. We talked about that in a few months ago, but we'll discuss it again. It refers to the scepter which you're referring to. David, of course, all the way through the Messiah, doesn't part from the line of Judah. Well, how come it's right now in Benjamin's line?
Does God put it there?
It's a rulership.
It hasn't been given to Judah yet. Yes. It can go anywhere under the sun God chooses.
The scepter that does not depart from Judah has not been given to
him. Exactly. Once it's given to Judah, it stays Judah's until the one to whom it belongs arrives.
The chosen tribe, even. Ephraim, even the ark and everything was there until it went to Judah. So
that's true.
It had been in Rachel's kid's family until it was given to Judah.
She's absolutely right. She's referring to, I forgot the number of chapters. It goes, I think, four chapters earlier. The Ark of the Covenant, when Eli, the high priest, blew it, his sons, God killed them all, took the Ark from Shiloh, which was in Ephraim's territory, all the way down to, I forgot the name of the town, but right now it's in Judah's territory, currently. They don't let go of it. It's theirs. The kingship, when they get it, they don't let go of it. Messiah didn't deviate. David and his line never deviated. Once they've got it, it's theirs. That doesn't mean that it can't be somebody else's before they get it, which is what God chose. Temporarily, it was in Benjamin's territory, to Benjamin's hand. Saul knew those prophecies. Judah's leadership knew those prophecies. That's one of the reasons they asked Samuel for a king. What did they expect? A king to come from their own line? They were expecting this. They didn't get it, but they were expecting it. Mm-hmm. It was given to Saul temporarily, but they're expecting it. They know it belongs to them. Okay, both of your hands up. I'll Susan first.
I was just thinking how interesting it is that you have Judah and Benjamin here. You have Saul and then David. And then later on, that is going to be picked up again in Yeshua, who is a David, and Shaul, Paul. So it's like first Shaul and then David, then Yeshua and then Shaul. I mean, it's mirrored. There is a mirror picture there.
God reuses things.
Same tribes.
Same tribes. Same process. Your hand was.
I was saying the exact same thing. It seems, you know, just as Saul, they didn't expect Saul coming. The Jews still didn't expect Yeshua coming. They're waiting for the reigning king.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what we discussed a few weeks ago. The same thing. They went, even when they got Saul, there's a king and there's a rulership. Someone said, "Excuse me, are you expecting to take this guy? I don't think so." And they rejected him. Well, that sounds awful familiar when they saw Messiah and said, "Excuse me?" Reject him too. Ellie.
Well, these people are still aware of the prophecies in Genesis 49.
Yes.
And they
knew, they're committed to memory.
Right, that this lawgiver is theirs. Yes.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. They knew the prophecies. They knew exactly every leadership person, head of household, by the way, it's a leadership head. And it doesn't mean like you, your wife, and your kids. It may include your brother-in-law. It might include your uncle, depending on which family of your line happens to be dominant. You could be actually head of many households, technically. But they all can read. They all know history. They all know the law. They have committed to memory because why? It affects their direct future. Tammy, thank you.
The other thing is here is like, yeah, when you talk about once Judah obtains a scepter, they grasp it and this kind of thing. But in a sense, Benjamin, in a small sense, does that too, insofar as later on, we're going to actually celebrate the holiday here in a week or so. Kish's line mm-hmm. also, in a sense, holds some degree of sway over the people as well, because we Correct. See it later on even in David's life, because David spares some of the sons of Saul and this kind of thing. And later on, one of the daughters named Esther
yep.
and Mordecai, one of his sons, later on also is... rules, in a sense, the
yes.
people.
Yes, the descendants thereof.
Descendants. Yeah. Especially
you
call a right-hand man.
Shut up, stop. Stealing in for Dave, are you, Jeff? okay, so I said there were two reasons why they're counted separately. I gave you one of them, which is Genesis 49. The other one, God chose. In Judges chapter 1. You don't have to go there right now, but I'll tell you really quick. When they have to go and take the territory, take out land, they say, okay, which tribe goes first?
Judah.
Judah's first. Yeah, we won't go right now. It's not terribly important. But Judah selected first. And who selected him? God selected Judah first. Judah's the dominant tribe, and what does that usually mean if you're the dominant tribe?
Yeah.
You're the leader. You're the one who's on the front of the line, not the guys who are in the back doing the cleanup work. Mm-hmm. You're the one who takes the brunt of everything, mm-hmm. not the ones who you are protecting. Mm-hmm. Say it again?
Oh, I was just wondering what the name of Judah meant.
Praise, I believe. Yeah, I double check the word in praise. Yes, Ellie.
They're the ones who get shot at.
They're the ones who get, even today, they're the ones who get hurt first. Mm-hmm. Nothing's changed. They've been selected.
The whole world's still afraid.
Yes, it is. Yeah, God willing. They get selected. God chose them to do a task. And they've held up to their end of the bargain. Yeah, they drop the ball periodically. And who doesn't? But they've held them, they are still on the front line. They're still the ones God chose to be the forefront, the beginners, the ones who take the run of everything to protect everybody else. So nothing's changed.
That includes Revelation where it goes after.
Yeah, remnants of Judah.
The ones he can find.
They're still the ones that he, yeah. Yes, the ones he can find. So that's one of the primary reasons why Judah is kept separate. And Saul continues the respect through chapter 15, which we aren't there yet, when they have to attack Amalek. Judah, again, is counted separately when they attack Amalek. By the way, Amalek's back down the bottom. If you haven't noticed my map up here, I'm sure you probably have. Amalek is down here just below Simeon's territory. Those of you who can see, okay. Sorry about that. Moab and Ammon are off to their lower east side of Israel. Ammon today, of course, is Jordan, and Moab's, well, it's a bit of who they turned out to be, but... that's the territory which they own. Philistines have this little swath of land that is taken out, a chunk of Judah and a chunk of Dan. They kind of own that territory. They have them in green, so it's easier to spot. Most of the tribes still live relatively peaceful lives. Not that they don't go to war. They probably go to war once or twice every, 5 to 10 years. Periodically it happens. Until they get a king. Then they go to war almost every year. Funny how kings do that. So, they go up north to Bezek. They count, they got 330 clans of soldiers. How many people are in a clan? At this point in time, we don't know. David is the one who defines a clan as 1,000 people. But David's not king yet. He's alive, but he's not king yet. So David didn't define clan yet. Does that mean there weren't 1,000 people in a clan during Saul's time? Well, no, they could have been. It could have been 50 people. It could have been 100 people. It could have been 100,000 people. It doesn't matter. Clan just means group. A family line group. That's all. You could, like I mentioned before, a head of a household. You could be head of your uncle. Depending on what family line you came from, you could be head of your nephew. Your nephew could be head of you. But amongst your clan, there are all your brothers, nephews, uncles, all those are males, in the clan. They're all included in your one clan. So clan can be large, can be small. Doesn't matter. So he's got 330 clans of men. They separate into three prongs. I'm not much of a military strategist, but if I was, I'd probably do it before I cross the Jordan, not after, because Jabesh Gilead is a short distance away from the Jordan. So Bezek is up here in Manasseh, the borderline of Manasseh and Issachar's territory. He splits his arms into three groups. I'm not sure their exact route, but I'll pretend. Let's say one came that way, one came straight, one came that way. I'm not really fancy, I'm not much of a military strategist, as I mentioned. Ammon, where are they? They're probably south of Jabesh Gilead, as opposed to north, most likely. Because that's the direction they would have come from. Mm-hmm. We don't know what actual route. Now, Hector had a route which, they had a couple of towns which they believe Ammon went through and would have come in from that direction. But I also, one commentary said they took out Reuben first. Which means they'd have to go through here, then go north. That's... No one recorded it. So we don't know. They didn't kill Reuben, they just took over the towns. Reuben doesn't die, he never dies. He's always around, all the way until, the kings from, Babylon come and capture the captive, and the Reuben gets taken then, but they're still around. So nobody actually gets extinct here. So Ammon would have, either way, they're up here near Jabesh Gilead. He comes, three prongs, takes them out early morning. Pretty simple strategy, nothing terribly impressive about it. Other than the fact he did it, which is always impressive. Putting them to death. Verse 12. Interesting point in Saul's first act as king happens in verse 12. So he accomplishes it. He takes out Ammon, saves his people of Jabesh Gilead. And verse 12, people said to Samuel, not to Saul, who is it that said, will Saul reign over us? Give them in over, and we'll put them to death. Why did they ask Samuel and not Saul? Isn't Saul their ruler? Yes, Tammy.
Samuel's still the lawgiver, so to speak.
He is. Samuel is the one who anointed Saul. And Samuel did not anoint Saul as king. He anointed him as ruler. Two different things. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to Saul? Or for Saul, I should say.
He's still under Samuel.
He's still underneath Samuel, because Samuel is judge. Mm-hmm. When Samuel dies, if everything went well and Saul did everything correctly, he would have been maintained kingship. It would have been given to him, because there's no one to take Samuel's position. Saul would have taken it. But that didn't happen, of course. We already know that story, which we'll get there. We'll read there in a few chapters from now. We already know that Saul blows it. But in this particular instance, Samuel outranks Saul. So why do people go to Samuel? Because you're more important than you would know. He would know who said no. Who said, and I don't like Saul. He would have known that information. They go to Saul. They go to Samuel, ask him. Saul, of course, says, Saul intervenes. Saul steps up as king, as he should be, ruler per se. No. He's still a humble guy. He's still an honorable person at this point. He's still somebody who you would look up to and respect. He could have easily, as king, said, you, your families, go ahead and die. He could have done that. He didn't want to. Why? Because it wasn't the right thing to do. He didn't mind the people rejecting him. Did the Messiah mind the people rejecting him? No. He didn't condemn them to death. Quite the opposite. Saul's no different. Saul's the same persona, the same type of character as the Messiah was. The same things are going through Saul as they're going through the Messiah. So Saul, of course, says no, steps in, it's not going to happen. And that, I think, is the turning point of Saul, when Saul realized, I can do this. I can actually be a king. Samuel, I believe, realized this as well. Because if you recall correctly, back in chapter 10, Saul was anointed king by Samuel where? In Gilgal, this little town right over here. which is the beginning point of where Joshua and all the tribes crossed the Jordan. As Jordan stood up at the tall water, they crossed it and they conquered all of Canaan. They started out in Gilgal. What does Gilgal mean? Rolling away the reproach of God. Nice name for a town. Wouldn't they want to live there? Yes.
Well, not only was Saul playing the part of the Messiah in the fact that he was being kind, he released people from a death sentence.
Yes, he did. And he had the right to kill them.
Guilty people.
Yes, they're guilty. You can't confess you didn't do it. You in fact did do it. Saul had the right to do so, but he chose not to. So you all go to Gilgal with Samuel leading them. They reaffirm Saul's kingship. Now Saul actually has the will of the people behind him. You see, before he didn't. Before he went back to being a farmer in Gibeah Saul. He went to being a farmer. That's what he was before, that's what he still was. But at this point, the people finally said, okay, now I'm going to follow you. Now I'm going to agree to do what you ask. Because why? You fulfilled a one fundamental prophecy. You paid back the people who saved your life. We didn't discuss that too much. The people of Jabesh Gilead saved Saul's life. They saved Ehud's life, which we already know. He's the one of the first judges. They saved the entire lives of all the people of Benjamin through their own personal death and kidnapping. A few died. Actually, not that many. A few of them died. They saved Saul, and Saul saved them. Saul is a savior. And eventually, he is a savior. A type of savior. Not necessarily, you know, what we would call our Messiah, but he is a savior. So as I had mentioned when we first introduced to Saul, those of you who were back in chapter 9, asked, why would God choose him? Did he make a mistake? Because Saul wasn't a very good king. After the second year, he kind of just went downhill. Did God know that Saul was going to blow it? Yes. But God chose him as ruler anyway. Why?
Because he
knew that Saul would stay humble, but only for a brief period of time. Saul was only humble until, I believe, the second year. Then he stopped being humble anymore. Second year after he became anointed king. Then he became an arrogant jerk that we all wanted to kill. We've already read most of Saul's life history. He's not a very pleasant person.
Well, in Hebrews it says these people lived for our benefit.
Yes.
If the person at the Messiah's time was sitting down and they knew
and they
that
read
the
story.
King from David, and they read this story, they could see the overlay. So Saul was playing a part in
God's
story.
Massive play. He's a symbol. Something for you to look at and say, hey, I see something here. I see my own Messiah amongst Saul. An unlikely location. Unlikely person to look at. He's not somebody which I would admire to be. He was rejected. No one wanted him. He finally came through. He did the first major task of saving the people that needed to be saved. That helped him. Though he was long, before he was even born. It was an important event. God didn't arbitrarily choose Jabesh Gilead for Saul to come. It was chosen because those people saved him. God didn't just arbitrarily choose Saul in Gilgal, where it was located at, to be anointed king. That was a rolling away the approach of God. He did that to Joshua and all of his people that were with him. Saul was chosen to get a symbol for all of us to read, to learn something from this man. Yeah, he was anointed as a ruler, but not as a king. He didn't get the benefit, the blessings that David gets. He didn't get the promise that David was going to get. He didn't get any of the good things that David was going to get. None of the rights of king were given to him. But he did his job anyway. That's an admirable person. That's a start out from very humble beginnings. Worked his way up. People didn't like him much. And he earned it. He earned the respect of all people, including Samuel. That's an impressive man. I would fear to think what Samuel would think of my personal life. I'm sure he probably wouldn't like it. I'm sure he wouldn't like any of your personal lives. Samuel was a unique individual. He was a godly man beyond all end. He was judge of all of Israel. He judged all their matters, good and evil. He blessed and cursed all people for various things they did or didn't do. He was their judge. Now, can you imagine? I don't have a good example of the Messiah coming into your personal household and say, you know what? Here's my list. And he pulls out this huge dictionary of pages of things you should be doing. And here's the one sheet of things you actually are doing correctly. It's that type of individual Samuel is. Saul earned his respect by delivering when he needed to. This is a prophecy of our Messiah. Yes, Susan.
I think it's also a demonstration to Israel, just like it is with David and Solomon and all the other human kings, because we know from Torah that God himself wanted to be king. And just like even today, Israel's own, even with the creation of the state of Israel, which is a manner of saving themselves. But I think that all of the kings, and it began with Saul, it's a pattern we see, until it's to show the people, it's a demonstration to the people, there isn't going to be a king in the manner that they were all hoping for until they say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. Because that is the only king that is going to rule them the way they really wanted to be ruled in the very beginning.
The way they intended to be ruled. The way which God was intending to rule. Very true. I don't think there are any other terribly important comments regarding the section. Oh, other than the fact that God himself, after the people finally crowned Saul king a second time, God then started to call him king. Not my king, but he called him king. God never anointed him king. Samuel never anointed him king. The people finally chose him as king. Again, another parallel. Did God make Messiah king? Our Messiah king? No.
But some people put a crown on him.
People did put a crown on him. What makes him king? Yeah, they mocked him. Much like they have mocked Saul earlier, they mocked the kingship. They mocked the man. They said he was worthless. He's of no value to me. But who finally makes Saul king? The people finally make Saul king.
They called him the king of the Jews.
They did call him the king. They did technically make him a king. The mockery of him, the king of the Jews. That is technically true. You're absolutely right. Just like, yeah, exactly. Not much of a law of reign. The people made him king. The people chose him. The people finally selected, you are my king. And then God said, all right, I will call you king. Yes.
But also, at his birth, Jesus was called King of the Jews. He was born King of the Jews.
Who called him that?
Well, the people, like in the triumphant entry. When
yeah.
I think she's probably referring to
at his birth. Yeah,
Right. That's true. The king, they that's true. You're right. I couldn't think of who it was. That's right. The Magi did do that. You're absolutely right. Again, there are people who selected him king. Just put the point. People selected him as king. People finally chose him. The people finally have to say that too. The Baruch Haba B'Shem Adonai. The people have to select it. The people have to say it. They've got to do it. God's already done his task. Now it's ours.